As we noted earlier, at the moment, all roads lead to Paris for many passionate about climate protection, including writer Wen Stevenson.
I'm a father of two young children, a 15-year-old son and a now 11-year-old daughter. And when I thought about this situation and the world that they are growing up into and what this planet may be like within their own lifetime, it really lit a fire under me.
But the concerns of Wen Stevenson go beyond his own children. He also sees climate disruption through the lens of the billions who didn't create the global warming problem, but who are on the front lines of suffering. A former journalist, he has turned into a climate activist and published a book called What We Are Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice.
There wasn't any one moment, I don't think, when I realized I needed to take this leap into activism any more than there's sort of a single moment when sort of night turns to day. But in late 2009, we saw the UN negotiations in Copenhagen fail. And a lot of people felt that this was a make or break moment for the planet. And I was watching that very closely. And then in the spring of 2010, it became clear that even very weak bipartisan climate legislation in the US Senate was going to fail as well. And this was at a moment in my own life where I had recently left my last job, which was as the senior producer of NPR's On Point. And in that spring, as I was looking for what to do next, I wanted to start writing again. And it was at that moment in that spring of 2010 that I had my kind of holy crap moment, you know, on climate change and realized that, look, we're not dealing with this. And I decided that I couldn't imagine getting up in the morning and working on anything else. Especially someone in my position with my privilege. I had the ability to, you know, at that moment decide how to spend the rest of my life. I decided this was the thing.
The preface of your book, and let me quote, "This book represents no more or no less than my own search for the moral and spiritual wellsprings of that kind of courage and commitment, and my search for that, the very idea of climate justice."
Yeah.
And in your book, your search for courage and commitment on the climate movement starts with personal reflection and a meditation on Henry David Thoreau. Henry David Thoreau, of course, famous for writing Walden, famous for living out there, probably a little less well known, as you point out in your book, for being really active as an abolitionist. What if Thoreau's story inspired you?
So what I realized around this time in my life, I had started taking walks around some really beautiful conservation land around near where I live. I live in Wayland, Mass., which is west of Boston. And just down the road from Walden Pond, really, my house is about 5 or 6 miles south of Walden Pond. And that was one of the places that I occasionally would walk. In fact, one time I decided to get up early on a Saturday morning and walk to Walden Pond. But it really didn't have much to do with Henry David Thoreau at that point. It was just for the sake of walking. But when I had my climate freakout moment in the spring of 2010, I decided to go back to Thoreau. And the thing I realized as I went back and reread and read Walden, read his great essays, is that not only is Henry David Thoreau a really deeply spiritual writer, something I had never really thought about before, on top of that, Henry Thoreau, who's sort of this icon of the American environmental movement, was not an environmentalist, you know, quote unquote. That word would have meant nothing to him. But what he was, unquestionably, was a radical abolitionist. He was a human rights activist. He was deeply involved in the Underground Railroad, along with his mother and his sisters. He personally sheltered runaway slaves, defying the fugitive slave law there in the early 1850s. At one point, he even spirited an accomplice of John Brown's Harper's Ferry raid. And this was at no small risk, personally, to Thoreau. And this man he was smuggling out of Concord, you know, had a price on his head. And so the way I think of it, the way I articulate this in the book is that Thoreau's very spiritual awakening in nature really led him back to society and to a very radical political engagement on behalf of his fellow human beings. And so as I like to think of it, as I put it, for Henry Thoreau to live in harmony with nature, so to speak, really is to act in solidarity with one's fellow human beings, because the two can't really be separated.
Wen, tell me, what's the difference between climate justice to you now
yeah.
and, say, environmentalism?
Right. Well, there shouldn't really be any difference. Honestly, for someone like Henry Thoreau, as I was just saying, there really wasn't. There wouldn't be any difference. You would see them as all the same. But there are those, even in the climate movement, certainly plenty of policy experts and people working on this at a political level in Washington, who don't really like to talk about justice. I mean, they don't really want to talk about race or inequality. They don't want to talk about the distribution of wealth, whether at the national level or much less at the global level, where Pope Francis has reminded us we owe the developing world, the majority of the world's people, an enormous debt, a sort of climate debt or ecological debt. They don't really want to talk about these things because they're politically inconvenient. And, you know, I don't really want to talk about these things either, because it's hard to talk about structural forms of oppression that are at the root of this crisis and that prevent us from really honestly addressing it. But, you know, if I'm serious about this, if I'm serious about justice, if I'm serious about climate, morally serious about it, then I have to face these things. And I think we do as a country.
Your book is structured both with your own personal epiphany and how you've dealt with that. But then you go ahead to tell the story of climate activists, and you compare them to the abolitionists, the folks who struck out in such a radical way to fight slavery. In what way do you consider climate justice activists the new abolitionists?
Right. Well, I think first, it's really important for me to say, as I try to make crystal clear in the book, that I'm not comparing climate change to slavery, which would be perverse. What I am doing is drawing inspiration from the abolitionists and from the abolitionist movement. I'm saying that our situation calls for a movement that's every bit as radical and resolute, sort of morally and even spiritually, as that movement and other radical human rights movements, you know, in our history. The narrative arc of my personal story is really that of going from, you know, a kind of self-absorption, I guess, to engagement. And it's about, sort of about the radicalization of a privileged white mainstream center-left liberal, okay? And there's an analogy in that narrative to what needs to happen socially and politically here in this country, because what has to happen is a kind of radicalization of the mainstream. And when I say radical, I mean that at this hour, at this late hour, to be serious about climate is to be radical, because it's really a radical situation, you know, and it requires us to go to the root of the systems that have created this. That's not going to happen until enough people really come to terms with and face up to the really radical nature of the situation. And historically, so to take it back to the abolitionists, I mean, historically, this is the only way that really deep revolutionary change has happened in this country, is when ideas and principles and demands that were once considered radical and extreme, the freedom of African Americans, for example, when these became mainstream, because radicals went out and forced the issue, right? Whether it was on abolition or women's rights or labor rights or civil rights, gay liberation, marriage equality, all of these human rights struggles, radicals have forced them into the mainstream consciousness and brought about a kind of moral reckoning in our society.
You profile a number of people in your book who've gone through that process.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some here. Perhaps we could begin with Tim DeChristopher.
Absolutely. In 2008, Tim was an economics student at the University of Utah. He had had his own very profound kind of awakening to the climate crisis. And Tim found out about a Bureau of Land Management auction that was going to take place in Salt Lake City, in which leases to drill for oil and gas on public land in southern Utah were going to be auctioned off. And so he decided to go to this auction and join a protest outside because, you know, this issue of drilling leases on public land is certainly a big environmental issue. And he went down there and he had been preparing himself for a while, you know, to take some kind of bolder, more confrontational action. And he gets down there and there's this little protest going on outside, you know, people walking around holding signs. And it was very tame. And he decided to try to get inside the auction. And they ask him as he walks up, you know, so are you here for the auction? And he says, yes, I am. And then he goes over to this table and they ask him, so are you here to be a bidder? And he says, yes, yes, I am. And they register him as bidder number 70. And he goes into the auction and he's sitting there watching these parcels of public land being auctioned off at bargain basement prices, basically given away to oil and gas companies. And he decides to take action. He starts raising his paddle and he starts actually winning bids for parcels of land until finally he's won bids for thousands of acres worth about almost $2 million that he, of course, has no way of paying. And so he's arrested. He goes to trial and he's ultimately sentenced to 2 years in federal prison for what he did. His trial became quite an event in 2011 and really helped galvanize the climate movement, the climate justice movement, and helped make the climate movement more confrontational and more open to civil disobedience and direct action. He was released in April 2013, and he came to Harvard Divinity School. He's someone else, kind of like Thoreau, who was a very spiritual person, but who has been led back to a radical political engagement. And we sat down and we've had some very long, very honest conversations about all of this. And that forms a big part of the book. The last chapter of my book is largely my profile of Tim.
Bill McKibben and others were really highly effective at rallying people to oppose Keystone. And I'm wondering if the climate activism movement has turned its sights on public lands. Recently, there was a demonstration at the White House demanding that Obama use his powers to stop leasing public lands and onshore and offshore for the extraction of fossil fuels. What do you make of that development? How important do you think it might be?
Oh, I think it's hugely important. I think it may very well be the next front in the climate movement. Studies show that, you know, there's enough carbon in the ground in deposits on public lands in this country to more than cancel out the benefits of President Obama's climate policies. In fact, if we were to get it all out of the ground, you know, it would certainly wreck the climate. There would be no hope of ever getting climate change under control. So yeah, I think this fight is hugely significant, and I think it's where certainly one of the directions the climate movement is going right now is this focus on extraction on public lands. Absolutely.
You're very careful not to prescribe any actions in your book. You say that leadership is spread out over many groups worldwide, but what's your view of what we should do next? You call this a long haul kind of calling. How so?
I don't think that the climate movement needs to get deeply engaged in the nitty-gritty details of the current policies that are being proposed, because most of them, really all of them, you know, don't really address a situation at the scale and urgency that's required. And it's kind of pointless to get bogged down in a sort of gridlocked partisan debate over non-solutions. So what we need to be doing is really forcing the issue and telling the truth, however extreme it may sound, which is that we're still a long way from where we need to be on this.
So the negotiations around the UN Paris Climate Summit indicate that there will be some kind of a deal, although scientists who reviewed the present commitment say that it would lead us to a little more than 6 degrees Fahrenheit warming by the end of the century. How relevant do you think the UN climate process is?
So think about what you just said, 3.5 degrees Celsius. In 2012, the World Bank came out with a very influential report prepared by Germany's Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, one of the foremost, if not the foremost, climate science outfit in the world, saying that we're on track for 4 degrees and that a warming of 4 degrees is most likely beyond our civilization's ability to adapt. And so therefore, quote, must be avoided, which we're not doing. We're not avoiding it. I want an honest national conversation about what we're really facing, what the science says we're really facing, what it will really take to address it, and what the consequences of our failure to address it are likely to be. When it comes to that conversation, it comes to telling the truth or failing to tell the truth about climate change. You know, there are, I like to think of it as sins of commission and sins of omission, all right? Climate science deniers are guilty of sins of commission, right? They're telling outright lies. They're purposely misleading people and ultimately for profit, for political power. People like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, certainly not doing that, but they're guilty of sins of omission. They're not telling the whole truth. In fact, they're leaving the most important parts out. So they talk about what a serious threat climate change is, but they don't bother to mention that we've all but run out of time to address it in a meaningful way. And they don't tell us what's really necessary to address it, the actual depth and speed of the emissions cuts required. But no one in American politics is really talking about how large the gap is, you know, the so-called ambition gap between what's, you know, what we say is politically possible and what scientists say is physically necessary, right? And we're certainly not spelling out for the American people what the likely consequences of our failures are likely to be. So I would love to hear Hillary Clinton, for example, or Bernie Sanders, for that matter, really explain to the American people, really spell it out for us, just how far we are from addressing this, you know, and how they envision the United States leading the world in closing the gap. This is an emergency situation, and we need to start acting like it. So what do they propose that we do?
Gwen Stevenson's new book is called What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice. Gwen, thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
You're very welcome, Steve. Thanks.